Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Media Confidential, your weekly deep dive behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait to get to the heart of the story in the fast-moving, vital world of the media. I'm Alan Rusbridger, here in London.
I'm Lionel Barber, and hello from Tokyo. Konnichiwa.
Right. Well, that sort of stunned me slightly. What does it mean?
It means hello.
Hello. All right. Well, hello. Konnichiwa. What are you doing in Japan, Lionel?
I'm attending a board meeting of the Asia-Pacific Initiative iHouse think tank, the new Asia-Pacific outward-looking Japanese think tank. And we're talking about Japan's role in the world, national security, US-China, and a lot of talk here about, oh my goodness, is it really going to be Trump 2.0?
Oh, God. Okay, that one. Well, today, a, quote, terror channel that spreads incitement. That's the view of Prime Minister Netanyahu of Al Jazeera as he passes a law to close that station down in Israel. It's a move that has received condemnation from the U.S.
If it is true, a move like this is concerning. We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critical. It is critically important. And the United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do.
Much of what we know about what has happened in Gaza is because of reporters who are there doing their jobs, including reporters from Al Jazeera.
Israel has had a long and difficult relationship with Al Jazeera, accusing it of bias against Israel. 2 years ago, Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh was killed during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. And in December last year, an Israeli strike killed an Al Jazeera cameraman as he reported on the war in southern Gaza. The channel's bureau chief in Gaza, Wael Dadu, was injured in the same attack.
We'll be speaking to the award-winning journalist and human rights activist Khaled Mansour on what this means for the information flow from a war zone.
Also, how important is it for Labour and Keir Starmer in particular to win over elements of the right-wing press, namely the Murdoch titles, The Times and The Sun? Given that the circulation of both The Times and The Sun have dropped significantly since the days of It Was The Sun What Won It in 1992, and circulation figures of both papers haven't been released since 2020, why is the backing of these titles so important to Keir Starmer?
We're going to be joined by the political journalist and author, Tom Baldwin. Tom has written a biography of Starmer. We'll be discussing how he can try and win over the support of two newspapers who are traditionally, or often, backers of the Conservative Party.
So follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. And we're also on X, formerly Twitter, where we're at Media Conf Pod.
I don't know whether your inbox travels with you to Tokyo, Lionel, but what have you been keeping your eye on?
Is it Tuesday? Is it Tokyo? I mean, at the moment, I'm sort of so suffering from jet lag, Alan, but the serious point, I guess, is what's preoccupying me is the media coverage of Trump and his, despite the fact that he's posted a bond of nearly $200 million after that adverse ruling in court, there is a growing sense, almost fatalism, Alan, both in the media and in people I'm talking to, that he's just on course to win a second term in November. Now, it all feels terribly premature to me, and I think the media needs to take a step back and not kind of prejudge the election.
Well, that's depressing news from Tokyo. Here, what have I been looking at? I was intrigued, and we might come back and discuss this on another occasion. The Independent has acquired, I think it's called the licensing, it's done some kind of licensing deal with HuffPo and BuzzFeed. And they're obviously positioning themselves as a kind of millennial news portal or something like that. I think we can unpack that a bit more on another occasion. The other thing that caught my eye is that after our revelations about Sir Robbie Gibb, who you remember was the owner of the Jewish Chronicle, the Jewish Chronicle has announced that it's going to be putting itself into some kind of trust. That's all we know. But it's another one to keep your eye on, because I think it's very new for any newspaper in this country to be owned by someone we don't know. Because Robbie Gibb, I don't think anyone thinks, is the real owner of the Jewish Chronicle. He certainly didn't put the money up. And it's breaking with the precedent to have a newspaper that nobody knows who owns it. And moving it into the ownership of a trust may be partly an answer to that, but of course it depends who the trust is, who's on the trust, who chairs the trust, and what the rules and the constitution of the trust are in terms of its relationship with the editor. So there's not much more to say at the moment, except it's one to watch.
Yes, of course you do have quite a bit of experience dealing with the trust, the Scott Trust, overseeing The Guardian.
Well, that's a very transparent, you know, we know who the owners of the trust are. We can look at the deeds and we can understand the relationship with the editor, which is basically it can fire an editor and it can hire an editor, but it can't really interfere in any way with the editorial content. I mean, if that's the model for the Jewish Chronicle, that would be great, but we'll have to wait and see.
The war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas rolls on, bloodily so, and as starvation looms for Palestinians trapped in Gaza, food delivery missions have been suspended following the death of 7 aid workers killed by Israeli airstrikes.
The World Central Kitchen Food Charity said that the 7 killed include citizens of Australia, Poland, a US-Canada dual citizen, and 3 from the UK. Now, gathering information from the war zone is vital. We all know that. We know that it's a really difficult job in this particular war. It's important because the world has to know exactly what's going on. And so this law passed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and overwhelmingly endorsed by the Knesset is alarming.
The law passed intends to ban international media from working within Israel, and Al Jazeera believes that this ruling is primarily aimed at them. So what does this mean for reporting on the conflict? We're now joined by Khaled Mansour. Khaled has a wealth of knowledge of the conflict, with over 30 years of experience in human rights, humanitarian aid, development, peacekeeping, journalism, and communication. Khaled, welcome to Media Confidential. You've obviously heard the news about the Israeli ban, which directly affects Al Jazeera. What is your reaction?
Well, firstly, it's very alarming. Israel has long claimed, and for good reasons, that it has robust media, critical media. I mean, when I need to read critical articles about Israel, I go to Haaretz, not to the New York Times, with all due respect. So this is really very disconcerting. And Israel is also, by having this rule passing the Knesset or the Israeli parliament and now in the hands of the executive to implement it in whichever way they will see fit, has joined the other countries. The only other countries that has banned Al Jazeera at one stage or another are Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain. This is not a nice company to be in terms of freedom of expression. The Jazeera is a Qatari-owned platform. It has English and Arabic. It has global reach. Hundreds of millions of people watch it. It is the most watched channel in the Arabic markets, more than the 4 following ones combined. Their news coverage is largely good. I would say they are less biased than Fox, for example, but they have an editorial line. I mean, editorially, the Arabic service, much more than the English service, is sometimes sensational, but it's certainly not a mouthpiece of Qatar. I cannot say that it's even a mouthpiece of Hamas. It has more Islamist leanings in its editorial and sometimes in its talk shows. But the news reporting, sometimes sensational, but it's as good as they get in TV stations like that.
So you'd say it's sympathetic to Hamas, but there are no organizational links or anything like that.
Absolutely. I don't know of any organizational links between Al Jazeera and Hamas. I will say that certain talk show hosts might have some Islamist leanings, but again, that's even less biased and does much less color the reporting than other well-established tabloids in the UK or the New York Post in New York.
Khaled, in mid-December, we had Samer El Youssef, a Palestinian writer, on the program. And he made the distinction between Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic. And he said that some people thought that Al Jazeera Arabic was like a Hamas propaganda channel. Can you understand what he meant by that?
I can't get into the head of Sami on what he meant. I can't agree with him on one specific issue, that the Arabic channel is different, indeed, from the English one. I can, by the way, say the same about CNN Arabic and CNN Turk and CNN English, because TV channels sing to their own audience. And if you have a big chunk of your audience is nationalist or Islamist, which are actually the two main ideologies that can find more space in the talk shows, again, I repeat, in the talk shows of Al Jazeera, then yes, that happens. They are the Arabic and the English differ in that. Still, I wouldn't call it Hamas propaganda channel.
Why do you think this has happened now? What does it say about the state of mind of the Israeli government?
Okay, so now divining the state of mind of a government at war led by somebody like Netanyahu is difficult, but I can look at the facts here. What are the facts? The facts that Al Jazeera has the only remaining professional TV crew for a global station in Gaza. So they are the only ones who would carry to a global audience. For example, the killing of the 7 aid workers of the World Central Kitchen a couple of days ago. Unlike other international journalists, whom I've seen their footage. They showed me that footage on their phones when they went on board C-130s, the American aircrafts that dropped food aid into Gaza because the IDF or the Israeli Defense Forces blocking the land route. So I saw that footage. Al Jazeera guys were down there to give us the footage of the 18 people who were killed either because some of these food parcels fell on their heads or because they drowned trying to get some of that food. Israel has barred international media from entering Gaza independently to cover. Only some highly controlled missions were able to go there. So besides that, Al Jazeera has, I would claim, the English one, has the best coverage of what's happening to the Palestinians from the point of view of the Palestinians in the West Bank, which is a very little covered story because everybody's fixated on Gaza, while about 450 people have been killed in clashes with the Israeli Defense Forces in various parts of the West Bank since the beginning of the year. Israel, again, like Egypt and like Emirates, has never loved or liked what Al Jazeera does because Al Jazeera spends a lot of money on covering stories that nobody else covers that are embarrassing for them.
It is worth underlining that a number of Al Jazeera journalists have been killed in Gaza while trying to cover this conflict. They've paid a heavy price. And so what you're saying is, what you're also saying is that Al Jazeera is on the ground where other Western and other news organizations, they're simply not present.
It is true. They tried to go, but the Israeli government has banned them from going. But those guys are still the only ones on the ground, not only Al Jazeera reporters and journalists and their families. As a matter of fact, it's all well documented by the Committee to Protect Journalists have been killed. 90 Palestinian journalists have been killed in Gaza since the war started. again, I'm not going to get into the heads of the Israeli Defense Force or the Israeli government and understand why such a large number of journalists has been killed, or for that matter, why 173 aid workers have been killed in Gaza. But it's a very dangerous place for journalists. And indeed, as you started, Lionel, by saying that at least the Minister of Communication, not the Prime Minister, Minister of Communication in Israel, said that this rule, this law by the parliament, by the Knesset, allows the government to order the closure of foreign networks operating in Israel and confiscate their equipment. Okay, now, does this apply to the West Bank or Gaza or not? The Minister of Communication says not, but Gaza is effectively under Israeli occupation. Will that give license to the IDF if this is deemed a news organization that harms the state security under the law, not to consider them an enemy? And now instead of the 90 people allegedly being killed by mistake, now those guys will be a legitimate target. It's a very serious issue. I mean, even human rights and journalist rights organization in Israel are worried because, so what will be the next step? Because also you have either Israeli Arab outfits or you have even very critical Israeli websites that really give a great coverage of what's happening, the conflict that's happening. Will they also be deemed? Because this law is actually very broad. And harm to state security is defined by legal and security officials. That these guys are in the executive under the Prime Minister Netanyahu.
But of limited duration, is it not? It could expire in the summer.
Well, I think all of us thought in October that we were going to have a war for a few weeks. So we don't know. It's a slippery slope. That's what it's really a cause for concern by anybody who would like to get critical story from the media, a good story, a comprehensive one, reflecting all views. And that's, again, it's very alarming because Israel indeed has a robust media. And this is a very worrying sign.
Where will you get your information from now, and how much will this affect your knowledge of what's going on inside Gaza?
If I want to get footage, now I have to lean on my critical faculties and like go to social media and get a lot of stuff from Facebook and know what's good from what's bad. It's going to be very difficult. If those guys apply this rule, especially in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, and honestly, also, I've seen some great reporting by Jazeera English on the demonstrations in Tel Aviv. So if they apply that, they will limit the rights or the desires or the needs of many people like me, either in Arabic or actually in English as well, to get a different point of view. It's like forcing you only to read the Times or only watch CNN. You will get only one view. And for whatever reason, Al Jazeera has become probably the only coverage that we get about the West Bank, what's happening in the West Bank to the Palestinians there by the Israeli Jewish settlers and the Israeli Defense Force, and indeed what's happening in Gaza. It will become much more difficult to follow what's happening in Gaza for sure.
Khaled, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you.
Well, Alan, I thought that your question was right on the money, asking how are we going to find out what's happening on the ground, given that Al Jazeera has taken really a lead role here. They've had many journalists covering the conflict. But also, what does it mean for how the millions of Arabs who've been watching, what will their reaction be? Will it inflame passions? Will it make the situation actually worse, particularly long-term for Israel?
Well, I think it's just going to increase the polarization here. We know that most Israelis are wholly dependent on Israel news sources and don't have access or don't watch alternative points of view. Khaled mentioned Haaretz, and Haaretz, to its credit, has got correspondents monitoring and I believe still living in the West Bank. Very interesting piece by Gideon Levy recently about what's happening in the West Bank while our attention is on Gaza. We need that kind of reporting. Israeli citizens need that kind of reporting. And just to ban it, it seems to me worrying, counterproductive and wrong. I wondered, I don't know, Lionel, whether you saw there was a clip that was fairly widely circulated recently on social media of, I think you can only use the word assassination, of four Palestinian men who were walking down a road. And you saw two of them being taken out and then the other two taken out. And this was broadcast by Al Jazeera, and it evidently, I don't know how they got hold of the footage, but it was very graphic killing of four people who certainly seemed to be unarmed and just walking down a dust track. And you can see how that kind of footage widely spread around the world, why someone like Netanyahu would want to suppress that.
I would much recommend a piece by Paul Nuki, correspondent in the Daily Telegraph, which I read early this morning in Tokyo. I think it's excellent. And what it basically says, and there's a lot of on-the-ground reporting, is that the Israeli high command are not in control of the soldiers and the local commanders, and that the rules of engagement are not clear enough. And this has led, literally, to a breakdown in discipline and indiscriminate killing. Now, I know that sounds controversial, but if you read Paul Nuki's dispatch, which is long, it's a very good piece in the Daily Telegraph this morning.
Okay, I'll go and read that.
You're listening to Media Confidential with Alan Rusbridger and me, Lionel Barber. And after the break, we'll be joined by political writer Tom Baldwin to discuss how important winning the backing of Murdoch newspapers is for Labour as they approach the looming election. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Media Confidential. And before Tom Baldwin, here's what's in this week's Prospect podcast. Ellen Halliday, deputy editor, is joined by the author and journalist Phil Tinline. Phil's written a piece for this month's Prospect magazine examining the second coming of Donald Trump, what we were talking about earlier with Lionel, something that we're going to be looking at in detail, of course, over the coming months, I'm sure.
I'm just trying to think how many of them actually used the word fear. I couldn't say off the top of my head, but I think there's clearly a sense of, you know, at the very least, you know, serious urgent concern. I think some people are frightened. I think maybe there's a feeling that fear can be a little bit debilitating. It can be a little bit rabbit in headlights. I talked to somebody in New York when I was last in the States who simultaneously was sort of saying, well, you know, it's going to be terrible if he wins, but what do I do about that? You know, so I think it's trying to kind of go round that. But yeah, I think people are frightened.
So follow and subscribe the Prospect podcast. There's a rich archive of interviews with guest writers and regular columnists for Prospect. Also support the Prospect of a Better Future with our 25% off spring sale. Prospect's a stronghold of independent and unbiased journalism, needed now more than ever in this global election year. Contribute to a society driven by informed dialogue and constructive debate by subscribing to Prospect with our limited time 25% discount at www.prospectmagazineallonword.co.uk.
With the UK election looming, how important is the support of the Murdoch media in the run-up to the vote? Not so long ago, the tabloids and the broadsheets both played a vital role in swaying public opinion. But given how the media landscape has changed, is it that important nowadays when messages can be distributed all across the web in a matter of hours?
So we're very pleased now to be joined by Tom Baldwin, who has three areas of expertise in terms of the conversation we're about to have. He was a political correspondent in Westminster. He has been a spin doctor in his time, if he doesn't mind being called that. And he's also the biographer of Keir Starmer. And so he's uniquely qualified to comment on an interesting speculative piece by Archie Bland in The Guardian this week, which talked about an obsession in Starmer's office about getting the backing of Murdoch, either through the Times or the Sun or both. So Tom, first of all, how much does it matter if Labour gets the backing of Murdoch in 2024?
I think it probably matters less than some people think it does and less than it once did. Newspapers and Murdoch's newspapers are less important in the media debate than they once were. I think even people who work for them would admit that. They do still carry weight. They affect what happens on broadcast media. The BBC will have meetings to decide how to reflect what's on the front of the sun because they think that's part of their job. Yeah, if you have the sun really going for you, as Labour had when I was working for it under Ed Miliband, it's an unpleasant place to be. You know, I think what probably matters most to Labour now is to ensure that the sun is, you know, at worst neutral, or not sort of putting all the boats out to try and stop Keir Starmer winning the next election. There's a sort of three-part menu. There's a complete endorsement, like Tony Blair had in 1995, 97. There's the complete rejection, which Ed Miliband and Gordon Brown and Jeremy Corbyn had. And there's something which I think the sun should actually try, perhaps, which would be more interesting and be a little bit more independent and unpredictable.
Having said why it's important, how likely is it that they will get either suspension of hostilities or an outright endorsement from one or both of the Sun and the Times, based on how you read the tea leaves and read the papers?
I think the surprise is that it hasn't happened already, in that Murdoch, as we know, likes to back winners. He's got a proud record of the Sun having backed every winner of every general election since he owned the Sun. I think the two things holding them back is I think they're probably not entirely convinced that a Starmer government would be hugely popular after 6 months or a year, and they might want to take the gloves back off again. The other thing that's holding them back is Keir Starmer's own history with News UK. When he was Director of Public Prosecutions, he prosecuted the phone hacking cases, including that of Rebecca Brooks herself. And I think there is still a legacy of animosity in News UK towards Keir Starmer personally.
In your book, you draw attention to a column by Tom Newton Dunn. Can you just tell us the story of that column and the suggested truce?
Well, Tom Newton Dunn was someone I came across quite a lot when I was working for Ed Miliband, because he's political editor of The Sun at the time. And he certainly was among those telling Labour people at the time that the position Ed Miliband took against phone hacking and Rebecca Brooks herself, because she was family, would come back and haunt Ed Miliband at the next election. And Tom Newton Dunn wrote this piece in the Evening Standard saying that shortly after Keir Starmer was elected in 2015, a lunch was organised between two senior Sun executives, presumably including one of them being Tom Newton Dunn, where they offered him a peace deal in which he would issue a formal apology to the journalists he prosecuted at the Sun over phone hacking and bribing public officials. And then all things would be forgotten. And Tom Newton Dunn says that this offer was made in good faith and Keir Starmer never replied, in quite a sort of high degree of pomposity, I thought. I mean, Keir Starmer, and I've spoken to him about this for my book, he doesn't regret those prosecutions. He says on the record that, you know, we were dealing with very powerful people used to getting their way, and rules should not be bent for anyone, whatever they do and however important they are. He thinks it was right to prosecute Rebecca Brooks, even though she was eventually found not guilty, because the test is whether there's a case to answer. The judge could throw the case out at the beginning if there isn't a case to answer. The judge thought there was a case to answer, and he thinks the decision to prosecute her was the right one.
Now, Tom, you've sat on both sides of the fence, both in the newspaper and then in the political office. If you just go back to your old newspaper days, what's the discussion like amongst the top journalists about whether to endorse? And bearing in mind that there is a difference, as you said, between endorsing and essentially saying, we don't want this person to win, and therefore all the news coverage will be skewed against the candidate.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a degree of cynicism, and I mean, perhaps more so the papers I worked with than those that you edited, about the decision to endorse or not. I've never been convinced that having an editorial in a paper saying vote Labour or vote Conservative means a great deal to voters.
I kept telling that to my colleagues at the FT. They never believed me.
I know a great deal of thought and angst goes into it. When I was working for a Murdoch-owned newspaper, The Times, it was largely a Labour-supporting paper, and I felt quite comfortable in it. When it became a Conservative-supporting paper again in 2009, 2010, I felt less comfortable. And I think many journalists sort of like to feel there's a degree of separation from their proprietor. And I think the talented Times editors have always kept that sense of distance that, you know, they're not doing Murdoch's bidding. This is their own editorial independent judgment. I think sometimes recently, and I think perhaps even now, it feels a little bit that, you know, Murdoch is pulling the strings. We'll see. The current editor of the Times is, I think, quite a right-wing conservative, Tony Gallagher. I mean, he's made no secret of that. He comes from a Daily Mail background. If Murdoch wants to order him to back Labour, he'll have to swallow that pill, but it'll be a very difficult pill for him to swallow.
Is that how it works on the Times? Because there's always been the pretense that Murdoch will instruct Time as Sun editors how to vote, but it's never been clear how Times editors reach that decision, whether they read the runes or whether there's a sort of nudge and a wink. But do you think it would actually come to Murdoch saying, look, I want all my papers in line for this one?
I think most people working for those papers recognise that an indication is made. And then you have this sort of Potemkin process. You know, there's a meeting of big leaders, writers meeting, where they all discuss the pros and cons of the Labour Party versus the Conservative Party. But there is a sense that, you know, the decision has been made beforehand. It's like one of those sort of Putin elections.
What do you think Keir Starmer's game plan is for dealing with the media in the run-up to the election? Because you went through an election campaign with Ed Miliband. You saw what happened at the end with the famous gravestone or epitaph of pledges, scare stories around that, lampooning Ed Miliband. What do you think Keir Starmer's game plan is?
Look, Keir Starmer doesn't want to go into the election having a war with the Sun. He knows what happens when that, you know, when that sort of war is declared, and it's not a pleasant place to be, and it's a distraction, and he doesn't want anything which stops him winning the next election. He's very, very single-minded and driven about winning the next election, and he'll do what it takes. Does that mean flying thousands of miles over to Hayman Island like Tony Blair did in 1995 to kiss Rupert Murdoch's ring? I don't think he will do that. He'll go to News UK parties, he'll give stories to News UK newspapers, and he'll have polite dealings with people like Harry Cole, who rather ludicrously interviewed him the other day.
Why do you say ludicrous?
Because Harry Cole was asking him questions about, you know, multiple questions about whether he'd taken drugs, which is one of those sort of hoary old media things, you know, which I don't think people really care about. He was trying to, you know, claim that various cases that Keir Starmer had taken part in made him unfit for office. I thought it was a fairly ridiculous interview, to tell the truth.
So why did Keir Starmer do it, Tom?
Because he needs to have a civilized relationship with an important newspaper, and he will do so. That, you know, but there's a difference between being polite and having a relationship. You know, they're not blocking them from press conferences we once did under Ed Miliband. They want to have a productive relationship with News UK, and they will give them stories, and they will jump through hoops to a certain extent. I mean, I think there is a danger sometimes, and I felt this when I was working for Ed, that some would sometimes say, yeah, we will give you a front page story if you say this. And you find, you know, there's a temptation to then sort of fit your policy to their front page. At one point, you know, we ended up, much to my regret, and I thought it was a mistake, that we ended up calling for Ken Clark's resignation because he had made some ill-advised comments about rape. So you don't want to play into their agenda. You don't want to give them things that you wouldn't have otherwise have said. But I do think there's a strong case for having a decent, civilised relationship with News UK. And there are lots of really good journalists there who probably privately support the Labour Party. And you should have a good relationship with them. There's no point having some feud.
Tom, just lastly from my end, I mean, you've spent a lot of time with Keir Starmer. Do you think that he will reopen Leveson and look at the regulation of the press? Or do you think he will actually say, you know what, that boat sailed, I need to look forward, I've got much more important things to do?
I don't think he will, no. I think there are bigger media battles to be had about the future of the BBC and the regulation of social media. I also don't think that the regulation of the press, with the best will in the world, is a story which is particularly pertinent to most people's lives. It's a story that we care about a lot. I think our press has actually affected our politics. I think it is a problem sometimes. But I don't think it's absolutely central to delivering his five missions, which is what he wants to do.
Last question from me, Tom. You spent a lot of time with Keir Starmer and studying him. First of all, how thick-skinned is he? Because he's already been under a shower of attack, and there's going to be a lot more brown stuff tipped over his head in the years to come. Does that affect him?
I think it did initially. He came into politics quite late in life. He was age 52 before he became an MP. I think he was taken aback by the shrillness and the shallowness of the debate sometimes. What impressed me about Keir Starmer in this respect is he learns and he adapts. And the first iteration you see of Keir Starmer is never the last. I think sometimes the media have been quite slow to catch up. They had a sort of two-dimensional caricature of him early on, and they actually haven't recognised how far he's changed and adapted and improved in certain respects. So he has grown a thicker skin, and he'll need a thicker skin.
And the second question is just his attitude to journalists. Does he like them? Does he mix with them? Or does he suffer them?
He does what's necessary. I don't think there is sort of first group of people you'd want to hang out with any more than politicians are, actually. You know, he's got his old friends. That's who he likes to see. But he does what he has to do. And that involves rubbing shoulders with journalists, rubbing shoulders with backbenchers. He will do it up to the point it's necessary. But, you know, if and when he stops being an MP one day, I don't think he'll be spending his weekends hanging out with journalists.
Sounds a very sensible person.
Thank you very much, Tom, for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, Lionel, that was an interesting take from somebody who's seen it from all sides of the fence. I thought it was interesting, his description of the nod and the wink process by which editorials are decided in Murdoch land. But I tend to agree with him that it's not so much the editorial on the day that is of huge significance, but the way that the coverage is framed in general. And I thought he made a good point about, you know, they won't necessarily be looking for an outright endorsement, but they will be looking for at least neutral coverage.
Yeah, I must say, going back to the various times we discussed where the FT was going to stand on the candidates, you know, you'd have about 25 people in the room. I mean, it was impossible. I mean, it was way too democratic.
We had the whole staff.
I can't imagine how you handled it. Be interesting what the FT does this year. I suspect they're going to go with Starmer. Given what's happened over the last few years, and particularly Brexit, but that will be up to the top people at the FT. Certainly the proprietor won't be having any influence. I think Tom said it, Murdoch, he's going to back winners. So there may be a case made to him, possibly, I don't know, by the editor of the Times, that we have the chance to, you know, have an important say over the future of the Tory party. There's clearly going to be a leadership change after the election. Of course, I'm assuming they're going to lose. Certainly, it looks like that right now, heavily. But I think everything about Murdoch is he has strong political views and he has a certain ideology, a market ideology, but it's basically where the power lies. And if Starmer's going to win, I think he goes with Starmer. With conditions.
With conditions. I thought Tom, having spent a lot of time with Starmer, was interesting about the extra layer of skin that he has grown while in this job. And also a very sort of pragmatic view of the kind of relationship he needs to have with journalists and how that's changed over time.
He's not going to be having you and me around for tea, in other words, on Sunday after he leaves politics. I think that was the message too.
We'll have to bear that that burden. I think the one thing I would contribute to the debate around phone hacking is that I think we've forgotten, I don't know if you've forgotten, Lionel, but Starmer, right about the time of phone hacking, did a lot of consultation with editors more generally about drawing up the rules for when journalists would be prosecuted. And it was all around the notion of public interest. And it seemed to me a very sensible framework for, you know, what journalists could and couldn't do. I think Starmer is a pragmatic figure. It seems to me he's playing this one well.
Indeed.
Thank you to today's guest. And thank you for listening to Media Confidential. We'll be back next week and we'll be looking at the war in Ukraine. Has it become the forgotten war?
At this vital stage in the conflict, why have people taken their eyes off the war? Has it simply been replaced by other conflicts and developments? We'll be finding out why it's so important to keep watching Putin.
Thank you also for listening to Media Confidential, brought to you by Prospect Magazine and Fresh Air. The producer is Martin Pints Roberts. You can send any questions or comments to Media Confidential at prospectmagazine.co.uk or get in touch on X, formerly Twitter. We are at Media Conf Pod.
And remember to listen and follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week for more invaluable analysis.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.